When a biologist with the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department approaches Professor Don Mitchell with a proposal to track an endangered bat species, Mitchell was, to say the least, distrustful. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to this special Pledge Drive edition of Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with teacher and author Don Mitchell. His book, Flying Blind, One Man's Adventure Battling Buckhorn, Making Peace with Authority, and Creating a Home for Endangered Bats, is an engaging story of interwoven narratives, contemplations on nature and life. Professor Mitchell joins me for this edition of Ideasphere. Thank you for taking this time.
Thank you.
I relish the work you've done. One, it's very personal. And yet, you're writing about habitat for bats. In doing so, you're also writing about the human element. And who's flying blind, us or the bats?
I think the title Flying Blind refers to any situation in which you have to make a decision and you don't have adequate information to know what the consequences of that choice are going to be. And people are doing that all the time. Now, bats are not blind, but they would not have become nearly as successful as they have been without having evolved the sixth sense called echolocation, which functions like sonar on a ship at sea. So they, as they fly in the woods in the dark trying to hunt insects, they emit a loud ultrasonic cry, and then their huge ears pick up the acoustic shadow of that cry and allows them to avoid tree trunks and branches and to home in on even the tiniest insects so that they can gobble them up. And it occurred to me in the process of doing this habitat work that maybe humans have a comparable sixth sense, that when we can't see exactly where we're going and what we're trying to do, there's some other means of perception that informs us. You might call it intuition, you might call it going with your gut, but the human mind, in my experience, keeps circling around to the prize that it wants to catch, in the same way that echolocation helps bats, which are not blind but certainly challenged to see where they're going in the dark, to catch the bug that they're trying to catch.
Much like the bat rambling around your room one night.
Yes, I suppose most people have had that awful experience when you wake in the night and there's a bat in your bedroom. And that episode is kind of the marker from the time in my life when I was terrified of bats. And the book traces an arc of change from that position to somebody who has the profoundest admiration for them, bordering on affection.
A very interesting dichotomy that you point out in your book, in order for readers to understand exactly the stand that nature has in our lives, is to have your students in your writing classes that you were teaching in college to read the first segments of Genesis, because there is diametrically opposed information.
Yes, and I think this is vastly underappreciated. If anybody sits down and takes 20 minutes to read the first four chapters of Genesis, there are actually not one but two creation stories being told. And any reader can discern where the shift from story one to story two takes place, because whatever word is being used to refer to God will shift from God to the Lord God or something comparable. And that shift in nomenclature signals the shift in story. In the first story, humans are held to be the gardeners of nature, and our function, our God-given function, is to dress and keep the garden of nature. And in the second iteration of the creation myth, nature is under our thumb. Our job is to be dominators of nature, and the operative word is dominion. And those two stories really lay out the lines of a schizophrenic relationship between humans and nature that is endemic in Western culture.
This is the issue that you tackle when you're not only working with your students, but you're working with the care of the bats and the landscape, the farm that you have, in shepherding as well as forestry.
What happened is that I got involved in a contract with the branch of the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, under a program called WHIP, W-H-I-P. I'm not making this up, though it sounds, hindsight, it sounds hysterical. It stands for Wildlife Habitat Incentive Program. Wildlife biologists had discovered in 2006 that a federally endangered bat species, the Indiana bat, existed in the woods in our farm. And at the time, that meant nothing to me, but with the advent of white nose syndrome, fungal infection of bats that I'm sure we'll come back to, but that discovery in 2007, all of a sudden, bats were on the government's radar screen because they perform a huge ecosystem service to humans by killing insects by the gazillions. And so if there is a profound threat to the health and safety of bats, it was going to become a consequence to humans. So this contract offered me an embarrassingly small amount of money and some expertise by bat experts in forestry to reshape the woods in our farm to make them more attractive for bats. If you're trying to find your way into the gardening side of the human-nature interface and you wind up working for a program called WHIP, chances are you walked through the wrong door and you're on the side of the dominion, domination, the side of people who feel that humans should be the king, the potentate, the ruler over nature.
Yes. Okay, let's go back to the beginning. And this is what readers are going to find interesting. You were anti-government in the early years, 1960s, to the point that you actually served your government as a soldier, but you were a conscientious objector, so you were not sent to Vietnam. However, now you are involved with the government in trying to understand why this is happening to the bats and how to repair it.
Well, I guess, 45 years had gone by. In some ways, I had mellowed. I still have not forgiven the government and our leaders for the debacle of the Vietnam War. And at the time, it was somewhat controversial to be opposed to that war, but in hindsight, I think its stupidity is pretty widely recognized. When we moved to Vermont and began to have children and raise them, my wife eventually wound up working for the government of Vermont, and was responsible for a variety of programs to deal with child welfare. And I came to respect the importance of the work that she was doing. So there is no single turning point, but I will say that my motivations for getting involved with this were somewhat selfish because I was going to get a modest break on our property taxes by guaranteeing the preservation of this habitat for bats. And I was going to get paid a little something from the government and be shown how to do what they thought would be helpful to do in the woods. And I said to myself, well, if I'm going to invest this time and effort, why not take advantage of what they have to offer?
The book is Flying Blind, One Man's Adventures, Battling Buckhorn, Making Peace with Authority, and Creating a Home for Endangered Bats. Don Mitchell, the author. It's available in hardcover. You have a website, blog, or anything else you'd recommend for folks to check out?
Yes, our farm has a website, and the farm name is Trelevin, T-R-E-L-E-V-E-N. So anyone who searches on Trelevin Farm will bring up the farm website. Trelevin is my father's given name. His father died when he was 8 years old, and his mother remarried to a man named Mitchell. And my father's stepfather not only insisted that my father change his name to his name, but he forbade my father from ever mentioning his birth father. Hmm. And so in choosing the farm name Trelevin, we're trying to rehabilitate and keep alive that family name, which otherwise would have been lost to us. My name would be Don Trelevin if my father had not changed his name.
Hmm.
Much of the book, I would say, goes into a meditation on my relationship with my father, which was by no means an easy one. And he was, I would say, an authoritarian figure in my life who became the model for my animus against authoritarian people.
Well, I also saw a bit of a metaphor in here because you do write about your dad and your relationship. And in fact, there's one element that surprised you in his treatment of your 3 or 4 year old son at the time. And you related how he had treated you the same way. But what I noticed also was the figure of your father juxtaposing that with your feeling about bats. So the two are tied together because you called them flying rats, and you could have said the same thing about your dad early on.
That's right. The second arc of change in the book, which in no small measure is the story of the psycho-emotional journey that I was on while I was working in the woods, because I had hundreds of hours to think about anything, and my father had just recently died, and my thoughts kept turning to what had been wrong in our relationship. But the second arc of change is from my feeling toward my father as being a tyrant who I was never able to effectively satisfy or please, into a figure who I came to see as sympathetic and caring, albeit certainly a tragic figure. Mm-hmm. But I came to understand that his childhood had been much more rough and challenging than mine, and that he made certain choices that seemed at the time quixotic and wrong-headed, but that had spared me from much of the pain that he had had to endure.
Returning to the work you had with the bats, one of the first things you did, and I had not thought about this until I read your work, and that is what's called thinning out the trees. You go in and cut down some of the trees that may be blocking light. So it's lighting the trees?
In daylighting, you don't release the tree on all sides, but you release it on those sides that will allow it to have more direct sunlight shine on the trunk. We have in the Champlain Valley of Vermont a particular tree called the shagbark hickory, which bats tend to choose to make their daytime roosts in during the summer months. I'm sure in other parts of the country, there are other trees that bats will choose for this purpose, but in Vermont, it's the shagbark hickory. And we had about 150 big old mature shagbark hickories scattered across 70 acres of forest on the farm. But based upon the incredible research that wildlife biologists have done into bat behavior, because bats are by no means easy to study, but they had learned that if a shagbark hickory tree is out in open field, bats will never choose it to roost in because they are at too great a risk of being picked off by owls or hawks or other predators of bats when they emerge at night to go hunting. Mm-hmm. But if they pass a shagbark hickory tree in the forest and is totally blocked in by other trees in the forest, then they won't choose that one because it's not getting the direct sunlight that keeps them warm during the daytime. So to optimize the shagbark hickory tree, it needs to have a rather specific combination of direct sunlight on the bole of the trunk and yet some connection to surrounding forest canopy so the bats are safe when they emerge. And I've done this now for at least 75 hickory trees, but I still would not trust myself to make those choices. Mm-hmm. So a wildlife biologist who understands bat behavior walks in the woods with me, and we come up to a shagbark hickory tree, and he looks around and he says, if I was a bat, I think I'd go to the left up there, then I'd swoop down, and then he looks around the tree and says, I think you should take down that white oak, but leave the ash tree, and take down those hardhacks over there, but leave that maple. And by cutting down the trees that he would mark with paint to be removed, when that work was accomplished, the shagbark hickory tree would be optimized from the point of view of bat habitat.
It's fascinating to me that we come to that understanding, especially going back to where we began in Genesis. It's the web of life that we are just beginning to grasp in our understanding of the web.
And this web is so complicated that nobody of the scientific bent would make a straight line prediction that if we do this, that will happen. At the same time, we have to do this with great humility because who knows what other organisms have been using that same ecosystem for some other highly specific purpose whose toes we're stepping on by reshaping the forest on behalf of bats.
Something that you found very offensive in speaking of the web of life is when one of the scientists recommended that you get rid of the buckthorn by using glyphosate.
Yes, it wasn't the scientist, but it was one of the technicians working for the program called WHIP, Wildlife Habitat and Sensor Program. And I don't want to rag on the government too hard here, but it's incredible that in our society we have the policy apparatus and programs that are able to identify and respond to a rogue event in the ecosystem, like the arrival of white nose syndrome. I mean, only a very advanced and thoughtful culture would have that apparatus in place. But along with it, you're going to have bureaucracy. And with bureaucracy, you're going to have red tape and a degree of inflexibility. And you're going to have turf wars between different programs who compete for the same areas of responsibility. Along with the inflexibility, this government program had a playbook of things that had to happen on every contract that involved opening up somebody's forest to any extent. One of those tenets was that before the forest can be opened up, invasives that have made their way into the forest need to be eradicated. And I'm sure in California you have different invasives than we have, but in the Northeast right now, buckthorn is a very serious one. And it came from Scandinavia, but all these invasive plants were introduced by human beings for one horticultural purpose or another. And the buckthorn is just too competitive for the native species. So it tends to overrun the forest understory and create thickets that become impenetrable. And the government said, before you can do anything to really help the bats, you've got to get rid of this invasive. And it turned out that the only way to get rid of the stuff is to poison the stumps with glyphosate after you cut them down. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, the buckthorn resprouts from the same stump using the same root system almost every time. And it's gotten to where even the Vermont chapter of the Nature Conservancy has now come out recommending glyphosate as an approved means of controlling buckthorn. Mm-hmm. But again, glyphosate and other broad-spectrum herbicides have only been around for a few decades, and that's the blink of the eye in the history of human interaction with nature, and who knows what the long-range consequences will be. But when I read the fine print in my contract with the WHIP program, it turned out that if I did not control the invasives to their satisfaction, then rather than have them pay me a small amount of money, I was going to have to pay them some money for wasting their time.
Yes, in fact, one point there was a violation of contract, or at least it was in the contract. If you violated it, you would have to not only pay a fine, but some of the back wages, if you will.
Oh, I'd have to give back all the money that they would have given me, yes. Mm. And we're talking about a couple thousand dollars here for about 800 hours of work, so chump change.
Well, somebody reading your work is going to sympathize, because you do go into detail about the acreage and how you were trying to work with the garlic mustard, because you mapped it out very methodically, worked the land, and then turned around and said, okay, after 3 hours, this is what I've accomplished. Here is what I'm going to do in the next several days, weeks, months.
Yes.
I think that's going to be appreciated by the reader.
And there's a certain futility to this whole operation, because even if I control these invasive species on several acres of my woodland, not many other people are trying to. So from an ecosystem-wide point of view, these plants are destined to succeed. They simply have survival strategies that outstrip their competition. And human beings have been around to regulate the ecosystem for only maybe 10,000 years, if that. And the ecosystem, one could argue, is doing pretty well without our generous help.
What would you hope people take away from your work?
I hope people will think about how the ways in which we as individuals interact with the natural world has a lot to do with the ways in which we interact with each other, and vice versa. So if somebody dons an authoritarian persona in the interaction with nature, that's probably how they're going to behave with other people. And the opposite is true as well. And I think, for me, the richest part of the book is when I make the realization that just as every species carves out an ecological niche for itself, which means they discover strategies to get what they need, food, water, shelter, and to avoid what they're trying to avoid, like getting eaten by somebody else. And in the same way as human beings, as a species, has carved out an ecological niche, in a way, every human personality does the same thing. So part of the work of childhood is for each person to discover what's going to work for them to win affection and to feel, to some extent, powerful in the world, able to do things, able to change things. And everyone's trying to find ways to avoid rejection and avoid situations in which they reveal themselves as being stupid or foolish. And once a child figures those things out for themselves, they will not forget those strategies. They will cling to them, even long after they've become grown-ups, and perhaps those strategies are no longer relevant to the lives that they're trying to live. And then the saddest piece of that is that parents are often drawn to imposing on their children the same behavioral strategies that worked for them to win affection and avoid rejection, even though their children are living in different lives with different people and different stimuli, and the chances that what worked for a parent is going to work for their child is just about nil.
Very true. Well, Mr. Mitchell, I thank you so very much for your time. It's been a pleasure, and I encourage this as a wonderful read. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Flying Blind, One Man's Adventure Battling Buckhorn, Making Peace with Authority, and Creating a Home for Endangered Bats, Don Mitchell. Check out his website at trelevin.com. That's T-R-E-L-E-V-E-N. If you have any questions, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rathbun. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. And this is Pledge Drive at your public radio station. We're asking you to pitch in with your assistance, your financial help in support. Here's the number to call.